This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. Researchers say the best time to teach a second language is in early childhood. Children are ready to soak up another tongue, embrace it, absorb it. It may be that the best time to embrace Ayn Rand is in late adolescence. Talk to a lot of enthusiasts and detractors about when they picked up Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, We the Living. They'll tell you, as a senior in high school, as a junior in college, a friend lent it to me on a summer trip. You get the idea. In the anguished construction of self that's often going on during those years between puberty and adult emancipation, Rand's fiction and philosophical work cuts through the collection of shoulds, of adult moralizing, of childhood religion, and says, here's something that's unsentimental, rational, and says it's okay for you to be tightly focused on the most important person in the world, you. For many Americans, the affection for Ayn Rand lasts long after that first passionate romance. The philosophy that springs from her work, objectivism, holds strong intellectual appeal at a time when we're in a great national contest over how to proceed as a country. We're in that contest whether we know it or not. Do we as human beings really achieve the greatest good for the greatest number by telling other people how they should live? Or does each one seek his or her own highest happiness, and that gives us a population that's overall living better and doing it without coercion and collectivism? Ayn Rand this hour on the program. Peter Schwartz joins us from the New York Bureau. He's chairman of the board of the Ayn Rand Institute and the editor and contributing author for the forthcoming book, The Return of the Primitive. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Arianna Huffington is in Los Angeles. She's a syndicated columnist and author. Arianna, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Ray.
Our number in Washington, whether you choose to call it or not, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And Peter Schwartz, it is remarkable how well these books sell year after year. Their presence in bookstores, the enthusiasm that people use, that you can hear it in their voice when they discuss the work of Ayn Rand.
Yes, it is remarkable, and it's stayed consistently that way. Her books sell over a quarter of a million copies each year, and they show no signs of abating. And I think it's exactly what you said in your introduction. What Ayn Rand offers people is a basic philosophy for living, a philosophy based on reason. And it's a philosophy that appeals to rational people searching for some guidance in their lives, because it tells each person that he has the moral right to exist for his own happiness. He does not need to live, he should not live by sacrificing himself to others or others to himself. And what she tells them is reason is man's means of knowledge, and therefore rational self-interest should be his highest virtue.
And rational is self-interest defined how? I mean, for anybody who's ever raised children, if you processed every decision you had to make about the raising of those children through a strictly self-interested model, you might not raise them the same way as if you felt that you were being like the stork of mythology and plucking your own breast to bleed to feed your babies. I mean, it's two very different ways of looking at the world.
No, it is two different ways of looking at it, but I don't agree that there's a conflict between your self-interest and raising children. Imagine if you wanted to raise children based on something other than rational self-interest, well, you'd say, okay, the neighbor next door makes less money than I do. Why don't I abandon my children and go to work and provide for his children? Your children are of value to you. It's in your self-interest. You decided to have them. The stork didn't bring them. It was your decision, presumably a rational one, and therefore you will undertake to provide for them. You want them to be happy. You want them to be well-fed and well-clothed. There's no conflict between your children and your self-interest, any more than there is between any value of yours and your self-interest.
Arianna Huffington, if you follow this road down to its ultimate conclusion, do we end up with a society that you want to live in?
Actually, no. And Ray, you know, I have had my own Ayn Rand journey. I fell in love with Ayn Rand when I was 11. And I was living in Athens, Greece, and I read all her books translated in Greek. And I was totally besotted by her and worshipped at her shrine to such an extent that one of her books, entitled The Virtue of Selfishness, was my personal Bible. And the headmistress of the school had to call my mother in to say that she was worried about my socialization process. And I fell out of love with her in college when I was at Cambridge studying economics, and where I realized that even free enterprise philosophers and economists like Alfred Marshall had recognized that private enterprise could not be sustained without what Marshall called economic chivalry, without the recognition that the public good, not coerced, not in a collectivist form, but awareness and working for the public good are major components of any free market economy. And without it, we live in a jungle.
No, I don't agree with that. I think that there is no way to have any kind of society or any kind of economy whose standard is the public interest to be anything other than collectivist. My view is that the kind of society we need is laissez-faire capitalism, where each person is free, that there is no government coercion. No one puts a gun to your head saying, this is how you must live, this is what you must do with your money, this is how you ought to spend your life. It's your decision. And if each individual is free to do that, the way you have a society is by people trading voluntarily with one another. You trade value for value, as against the way it is in a collectivist society, where each person is sacrificed for the sake of some mythical public good.
I'm not suggesting that kind of sacrifice. I'm suggesting something that comes as an impulse of the heart, and that's something that we strive to achieve. I remember, for example, what your institute put out during the President's Summit in Philadelphia. I don't know if you were part of that material that came out, but there were words like an anti-American servitude summit. That's how the summit was described. And it was, and you actually, not you personally, but your institute, protested its philosophy of dictatorship. And I was kind of amazed. I couldn't understand why a summit that, however many its imperfections, was trying to encourage people to give back, to give to others beyond what they were giving to their immediate nuclear family. I can't imagine how it could elicit such strong negative response. And that's what made me kind of go back to my own journey with Ayn Rand.
Well, Arianna, you're talking about the summit on volunteerism in Philadelphia?
Mm-hmm. Well, as an example of how this philosophy translates when it comes to specific public issues.
Well, let me tell you why we were so against that campaign. Because I don't have any objection to, some company giving sports equipment to kids or donating books to schools. I think that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. What I objected to, and I think what the Institute objected to with this volunteerism campaign, is the premise behind it. And that was a very destructive premise. It was the idea that children need to be taught that in order for them to be virtuous, in order for them to be moral, they have to go beyond their own lives. They have to do something to sacrifice their self-interest. When they are living for themselves, when they're studying and they're pursuing knowledge for the sake of their careers and they're planning for their future, that is outside the moral realm, supposedly. In order for them to be considered virtuous, they're taught you have to go and deliver bedpans to the poor, work in soup kitchens for the homeless. And that, I think, is a very vicious doctrine. It tells children that they have no moral right to live for themselves. And I think they definitely do.
Well, I actually then must be bringing up my children according to this vicious doctrine, because I believe that my two daughters, who are 7 and 9, have a responsibility early on to give something back. Once a week, I take them, now that we live in Los Angeles, to places like a place called home in South Central, where they learn by themselves the value of service and the need for service to become part of their lives. This is not an alternative to working, to studying, to caring for their own future. But I'm trying to teach them that their future and their completion as human beings would really be very impoverished if they did not include giving back, if they did not include in their concerns those left behind. And you know what? This is the greatest biblical admonition in any religion. We are going to be judged by what we do for the least among them. That's the kind of admonition that I really believe. And you don't have to be a Christian to believe that, because whether you study the Talmud or Buddhism or any major religion, this is part of their philosophy of living.
But of course, Rand herself rejected that world of the transcendent, the world that can't be seen, the idea that there is a world beyond the world that we can experience with our own eyes, with our own senses. I don't want to turn this into sort of a summit on volunteerism part two, but I do want to talk a little bit more about that idea of living for yourself, Peter Schwartz. There are decisions that we're being asked to make as individuals in this country now, where living strictly for yourself, it would seem, is separate from the greater good or even the personal good. And there are decisions that you can make that might advance yourself, but then not advance anyone else. And like there are variations on the old diner's dilemma. If you're splitting the check, do you order surf and turf or just soup and a salad, hoping to lower everybody's bill? If as a big city, you in New York or Ariana in Los Angeles are wrestling with air quality and trying to reduce the number of automobile trips, a person who watches as everyone else reduces their automobile trip and then drives by car gets to experience the advantage of having cleaner air without having to contribute themselves toward that process of getting cleaner air. I mean, I'm just picking examples out of the air and trying to sort of process them through what Rand would say.
But you're looking at it from the wrong perspective. You're assuming that we've got this mass body of humanity and somebody on top has to make the decision as to how each one is going to contribute to the whole. And that is the wrong perspective to look at it from. The primary concern, the primary unit that requires guidance and requires principles to live by is the individual. Now, each individual has to decide how is his life going to be best pursued. It's true that sometimes your actions will violate the rights of others, but the whole concept of rights is an individualistic one. Each individual has rights. If I'm doing something that encroaches on your property, if I'm emitting pollution next door to you and you can demonstrate that it's harming your health or whatever, then you have a right to stop me. But that's because each of us has the individual's right to his own life, to his health, to not to be interfered with coercively by others. But it is not the same as saying we're just this mass organism, everybody owes something to society, and let's figure out how to collect that debt. I think you do not owe anything. You don't owe anything to society. You owe only something to other individuals with whom you voluntarily trade.
Well, I find this a very disturbing argument, especially coming from conservatives, because conservatives have argued for years that we don't need the federal government to care for the poor. We don't need great society programs. They are too coercive. They are too collectivist. Instead, conservatives have argued communities, individuals, churches, or if you don't believe in churches, voluntary associations are going to do the work of caring for the poor, for those left behind. Now, Peter, if you are saying that, in fact, we don't have the responsibility to do that in our own communities, and the government doesn't have the responsibility to do that, then my question to you is, then who has the responsibility to care for those left behind, for those trapped in the inner cities, for those trapped in schools where they cannot learn? Whose responsibility is that?
I don't accept that it's anyone's moral responsibility other than the person himself. I don't regard slavery as a moral ideal. That is, every single dictator makes exactly that argument. Who are you to say you've got rights? You've got to sacrifice for the sake of the collective in society. But you're 100% right, Ariana, and that's about the conservatives, which is exactly why I disagree with conservatives. I don't regard myself as a conservative. I think the conservatives are as much a threat to individualism and capitalism as the liberals are, if not more. I regard myself politically as a radical for capitalism. And if you want to know how to help the poor, the best way to do it is to give them as many examples as possible of people becoming rich. Let each individual go as far as his abilities and talents take him. And those who suffer some misfortune through no fault of their own, and there will be some small number of that in a society, will rely on private charity. I'm not opposed to the idea of charity as such. I am opposed to the idea that this is the basis for morality, that you are considered virtuous only to the extent that you sacrifice. I think the opposite is true. And if people want a further elaboration of this, read Atlas Shrugged. It is what makes someone virtuous is not how much he sacrifices, but something which is far harder, how much he devotes his life to achieving his values and to making himself a productive person.
Well, I have to challenge your definition of sacrifice, because when I do something that involves service, when I work, for example, with former gang members who are trying to change their lives, I don't consider that a sacrifice. Some of the greatest joy in my life, some of the greatest fulfillment has come from that work that I do, which you may consider to be against my self-interest or which you may call sacrifice, but I don't. This is what is perpetuating my values. So, I mean, unless we have a tautological argument where you define self-interest in a way that includes service, then you're basically saying that anytime I do something for others, I'm sacrificing, and I'm challenging that because I don't consider it a sacrifice.
The whole definition of service is that you subordinate yourself to others, that it is selfish and wrong for you to act on your own interests. And I'm challenging that whole premise. My view is it is moral for you to live your own life. It is moral for you to be happy. It is moral for you to regard your life as your standard of value. Now, every notion of sacrifice and of altruism means giving up something because it's for your benefit, for the sake of something that is not to your benefit. That is the meaning of altruism. That is the meaning of self-sacrifice. Now, the only basis upon which people can say, well, you know, giving up my happiness somehow makes me reach a higher level of happiness is a form of mysticism. You've got to abandon your mind and abandon reason and say, I'm going to be happy by giving up my happiness. I'm going to live by giving up my life. And I think that's a very vicious doctrine.
800-989-8255 is our number in Washington. 800-989-TALK. Peter Schwartz joins us from New York. Ariana Huffington's in Los Angeles. We're looking at objectivism this hour on the program, the work of Ayn Rand. And we'll go first to Phil in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, I'm amazed to find myself on the same side of an argument with Ariana Huffington. I'm shocked at Peter. I was a great devotee of Ayn Rand, read everything she wrote right up through the publication of Atlas Shrugged. And toward the end of Atlas Shrugged, after her 77-page diatribe on objectivism, I have Dagny Taggart committing cold-blooded murder. shooting a gun, pulling out a gun and shooting a guard who was in no way threatening her. And at that point, I said, hey, wait a minute. There's something wrong with this logic. Maybe there's nothing wrong with the logic, but it winds up with a cold-blooded murder. There's something wrong with the philosophy.
Well, you know, I'm just kind of amazed at the accusations against Ayn Rand that consist of claiming she is in favor of force in some way. There is no figure in contemporary thinking, there's no figure in philosophy who is more explicitly opposed to the initiation of force on every level.
Then
she is in favor.
How do you explain this cold-blooded murder that her...
Well, it is not... If you want me to go over the scene, I will. I don't have time to do that, but I'll just tell you, it is in self-defense. This is a guard who
guard
is physically...
The guard was in no way threatening Dagny Taggart. He was merely in her way.
Can I answer?
That's
this is
the thing
a guard,
that upset me.
Okay. This is a guard who refuses to get out of the way
exactly.
to enable
her...
he is physically preventing her from rescuing a person, the hero of the novel, who is being tortured by the statists in the book. Now, that the only way to remove that threat, since he didn't get out of the way voluntarily, is to shoot him. And that's everyone has a right of self-defense. But to accuse Ayn Rand of being an advocate of force is just bizarre. Why don't you say that she's in favor of too much freedom? You know, then we could argue that, but to say she's in favor of force is ridiculous.
Well, I don't think it's a question of too much freedom. It's a question of a kind of stunted view of human freedom. If you believe that human beings are driven exclusively by three instincts, survival, sex, and power, then you have a very impoverished view of what humanity is. If you don't accept that there is a higher instinct that we grow into, and that's the instinct for the transcendent, the instinct to make our lives be about something larger than our own existence. I mean, that is, for me, so central that any alternative view that does not include this instinct basically leads to what we see around us, human beings that think that by having enough sex, money, and power, they're going to find happiness, and they end up either in the Betty Ford Clinic or somewhere else, either drying out or trying to discover what went wrong with their lives. So basically, there's so much evidence that disproves, Peter, what you are claiming, that pure, unadulterated pursuit of self-interest is going to make people happy, that I don't know where you find your evidence that it does make people happy.
Let me just say, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Well, my evidence is from the people who regard self-interest as something to be rationally discovered. I don't believe that people are motivated by instincts. I don't think there is such a thing as an instinct. I think we each choose what our values and our philosophy in life is going to be. And in a roundabout way, Ariana, you're making the point that there is no way to justify the philosophy of altruism, the philosophy of self-sacrifice. There's no way to justify that except by resort to some kind of mystical, non-rational argument. Many people justify it by quoting the Bible. Others have a less overtly religious justification, but nonetheless come down to things like, well, there's an instinct for altruism, or there's some emotional drive to altruism. Anything except reason. There is no reason for altruism. If you go by reason, if you go by your mind and see what is out there in reality, what is required for human beings to live and to be happy, then the conclusion is, well, I have to choose the values that my life requires. I have to choose values of career. I have to choose a value of finding someone I love, etc. All of that is based on the evidence of your mind. It's not rooted in some mystical dimension. Reason and self-interest go together.
I think it's probably, you can live a pretty successful life using that philosophy only if you don't live in a world where everybody's living by that philosophy.
What do you mean?
Well, it's the idea that you can be an objectivist and be maximizing the utility of your own life and increasing the benefits to self, as long as you can count on not every other person that you run into in life having made that same choice.
Oh, I think it's exactly the opposite. What is it that you get from people? You get values from people if they themselves have produced values. You don't get something from a dishonest, corrupt bum. You get something from an honest, rational, productive person, in which case you have something to trade, whether it's a material trade or a spiritual trade. But why to pursue your life as an objectivist is made easier, not harder, by the fact that there are other people also making something productive out of their life.
Joining us now is Michael Paxton, director of Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life, a documentary about Ayn Rand. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well,
thank
what you. Drew you to Rand as a subject for a biography?
Well, actually, I discovered Ayn Rand in junior high school, and ever since then I'd always been very fascinated with her as a person, and also obviously became an objectivist. So that's always been with me for many, many years, and when a possibility of doing a documentary came up, she certainly was on the top of my list. So that's how I got started in thinking I should do something. And plus, something was really needed on the subject. Obviously, there hasn't been anything done on her or her life. So,
a fascinating life, born in Tsarist Russia, emigrated from the new Soviet Union, got involved in Hollywood Pictures, best-selling author. It really is an amazing life.
It's an incredible life, and it's amazing. Even as I went into the research of this and started to tell her life in the film, it was amazing to see how many just incredible things happened to her, which it would be hard to make those things up. You know, her meeting Cecil B. DeMille on her second day of being here in Hollywood, and meeting her husband to be also the day after that. So. She had an incredible life and went from, you know, from being completely poor and struggling in Hollywood to a famous author and then, of course, a philosopher.
Well, you know, people talk about Hollywood as a dream factory, as a place of paste jewels and Potemkin Village sets. And here's this really serious, rational woman who's always talking about the real and stripping away sentimentality and frippery from life, and there she is in the dream factory writing films and plays. It's an odd juxtaposition for an outsider.
Right. I think what's interesting, and especially if you see the film, what it comes across very clearly is that she was definitely a romantic, and you know, the idea that life is more than just your 9-to-5 job and you're, you know, getting up every morning and having breakfast. You know, it to her it was an incredible journey, and it was something that which is why she loved movies so much, because they essentialized those things, especially in the movies that she saw in the early 20s, you know, the German films that she saw when she was in Russia, and the silent films of DeMille that she was really, you know, that really inspired her. So I think that, you know, that it may seem like an odd juxtaposition, but in reality, going along with what Peter and Ariana have been discussing, I think for her, that is what, you know, made her look at existence rise above, you know, the mundane or the what people would call the reality. You know, it's not that she's leaving outside of reality, but for her, it's something that should be romanticized and should be absolutely revered, almost as a religion.
Well, she didn't live to see the end of the Soviet Union. But she certainly did live to see a time when the gap in what a society was able to deliver in the East and the West mm-hmm. was really becoming quite obvious.
Right.
Did she die a satisfied woman?
I think she certainly died as a satisfied artist and woman. I think it was certainly a problem in her life that she never was recognized during her lifetime. Certainly in the philosophical circles, Peter probably can give you a little more detail on that. But I think that, you know, the reviews of her books, and she really got very few good reviews for any of her work, and I was not really regarded. I mean, when I was in college, I was a philosophy major, and you know, if I raised my hand and talked about Ayn Rand, I was admonished not to discuss her. So she was not accepted in those circles, and certainly was not taught in the schools at that point. I'm sure that was a huge disappointment for her, but in terms of her own personal, as an artist and what she had accomplished, I think she was extremely happy.
Michael Paxton, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Paxton is the director of Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life, a documentary film about her life, nominated for an Academy Award in 1998. He's author of the companion book, Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life. Arianna Huffington and Peter Schwartz are with me for the rest of the way. The number is 800-989-8255. Connie's in Sioux City, Iowa. Connie, welcome.
Hello. My comment is a little more trivial than Peter and Arianna's has been, but I just wanted to share an experience about Ayn Rand. In my house, who is John Galt was a question that we would throw out when we were tired of discussing whatever we were discussing. And I also figured out in about ninth grade that if I just threw that question into an essay that I was writing, that I think my grade would go up half a notch. And so I used it throughout the rest of junior high and high school. And by college, of course, that had kind of worn off, but...
Because everybody's throwing it into essays by then, Connie. That's
right, exactly. But in ninth grade, you know, it got me grouped with the smart kids.
So, so you were using rational self-interest. Ayn Rand would be proud of you.
Yeah, so I'm enjoying the discussion very much and just wanted to share that.
Thanks, Connie.
Thank you.
And Cindy is in Sioux City. There must be sort of a hotbed of Rand readers in Sioux City. Hiya, Cindy.
Hi. I just wanted to share an experience also of a friend of mine who in the 60s we were in high school, and she read Ayn Rand and just read it over and over and over, considered it her Bible, so to speak, and I believe it formed her philosophies for her life. She became an activist, became involved in the SDS Society up in Michigan. And now I'm writing to her. She's in a federal prison because she made a bomb and blew up a house. And I don't know. I look at that as those books, as she was reading them in high school, helped to form these philosophies. And I'm just wondering what your two people would say about that.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, Cindy, because that ties in more directly than I could have hoped for to this new book, Return of the Primitive, which is subtitled The Anti-Industrial Revolution. This was a book Ayn Rand wrote in the 60s, which was originally titled The New Left, The Anti-Industrial Revolution. And it was exactly about the movement you're describing, the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, and other elements of the New Left, which she regarded as the exact antithesis of her philosophy. These were people who were the forerunners of this, you know, mystical back-to-nature environmentalist movement we have today. They were people who rejected reason and just wanted to wallow in the emotion and the whim of the moment. They were opposed to the products of a rational mind. They were opposed to technology. They were opposed to science. They wanted to go back to a more primitive, pre-industrial age. And when you want that, when you reject reason and go by whim, you will ultimately find yourself with nothing left but the resort to force. Faith and force go together in the same way that reason, self-interest, and freedom go together. So those are not examples of followers of objectivism, but quite the opposite.
Well, that, again, doesn't make sense in terms of 20th century history, because communism was the product of reason. It very deliberately rejected religion. It very deliberately rejected the transcendent. And it led to some of the worst atrocities committed in the name of a rational philosophy applied to politics. I think you're really attacking a caricature. I don't think there's anybody who wants to destroy reason. Just to stop viewing it as the sort of exclusive end or means of human existence. I mean, there is reason and we need to honor it, but reason cannot be the master. Otherwise, we have a very shrunken view of human nature. And even in that film of Ayn Rand, I mean, calling her a romantic, talking about her incredible journey, these are terms that define that in human life there is a need for something beyond pure rationality.
No, I don't agree at all. I think that reason is an absolute, because if you don't go by reason as your sole means of knowledge, then that means you act on whatever you feel like doing, or you act on the dictates of some authority that you arbitrarily designate, whether it's religious or not. And that means that, well, you'll act on reason whenever you feel like it or whenever your authority tells you you can. That is exactly the philosophy of every collectivist dictatorship, including communism. Communism, it's true, is not religious, but there are other forms of mysticism than religion. Marx said there's no such thing as logic. There's only, you know, there's bourgeois logic, there's proletarian logic, there's my logic and your logic, which is what the multiculturalists have taken up today. Marx was not an advocate of reason. He had his own mystical slant on philosophy. He rejected reason and logic, rejected individualism, and certainly rejected the idea of self-interest. So well, that is not...
Certainly somebody could say that you have your own mystical slant, and that's Ayn Rand and her philosophy.
I mean, well, why is that mystical? Why is that mystical if there is rational reason for accepting
because
it?
Because
is any belief mystical?
The only test of its rationality is because Ayn Rand said so. I've read a lot of this stuff that draws a circle and a boundary as the opening premises, like the givens in a geometric proof. It puts certain ideas inside the circle and puts certain ideas outside the circle, and that is it, and that's the only test that's necessary. And I got to tell you, that's what a fundamentalist would say the Bible does.
But that's exactly the opposite of what objectivism is supposed to be. It's not a philosophy that you ought to accept on faith. It's not a philosophy you accept because somebody, including Ayn Rand, said it's true. It's a philosophy that each person needs to discover on his own and identify whether he thinks it's true or not. The fact that 2 and 2 make 4 is not some mystical transcendent truth. It can be shown, it can be demonstrated in logic as to whether it's true. And that's true of any tenet of objectivism. You decide using your own reason whether it's true or not.
But it can also be
mysticism here.
But Peter, it can also be demonstrated that all the greatest scientists, if you read their memoirs or if you read their biographies, you'll see that they all really acknowledged intuition, a higher form of creativity, a higher form of inspiration beyond reason. I mean, Einstein said imagination is more important than knowledge. Just read Arthur Koestler's book on creation, and I challenge you to bring up one major scientist who said that his inventions, his or her ways of advancing science were prompted purely by reason.
But you're confusing two different things here. Things like imagination and creativity are not mystical things. Those are real. I mean, Ayn Rand was a novelist. You know, what's more creative than writing fiction? Creativity.
What about intuition?
I don't think there's any such thing as intuition or instinct or transcendental mystical insights. There's only you're looking out at reality. Now there are many things that you know that are processed in your subconscious that integrate all the material. You may have a problem that's confronting you, and it may take you a few minutes or a few years to figure out. And that is a creative process, but the creative process does not come from some mystical entity somewhere. It doesn't come from your glands. It comes from your mind processing the evidence that's before you.
Well,
that's how creativity comes out.
I know in my gut that I have to take a call now. Joanne's in St. Louis. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you.
Actually, you folks are now getting to a couple of points that I wanted to make, and I'm not sure that I can make them any better, but I'll give it a try and try to be quick about it. I, too, had my Ayn Rand phase in late adolescence, as you said, Ray, and still find her novels to be fascinating and find some of her philosophy compelling. But as I have matured, I have found that that there are a couple of really basic fallacies in objectivism. The very term speaks to me of an arrogance that is rather breathtaking, that it is the only objective kind of reality. But number one, I think it's a fallacy that reason is the only means of knowledge. I've had experience with mysticism. I know there are certain things I know just because I know them, and I cannot tell you why. And I did not arrive at them by any logical, rational means of knowing. And the second fallacy is that individuals are always free to act as they would wish. For instance, I'm thinking back in the early 1900s, in the industrial age, when, for instance, coal miners, sure, they had the choice, in theory, to not work for these coal mine operators that were exploiting them and having them work in dreadful conditions. But where were they going to go? They had little education, no training to do anything else, and were living in the hollers of Kentucky. What choice did they have? So in those kinds of situations and many, many others, coercion was required just to make sure that people were treated decently. And those people who were being exploited had no effective choice. And if you want me to take the answers off the air, I'd be glad to do that. I don't know if you want to engage in any kind of dialogue.
Well, hang around, Joanne, but let me say you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Joanne, I don't agree with anything you've said.
I'm not surprised.
I don't have the time. I wish I had more time. Just two quick, brief things. You say reason is not man's only means of knowledge. There's some mystical means. Well, what is it? If you claim there is something else, the fact that you label it as mystical means there's no explanation for it. There's no way to convince anyone of it. There's no way to communicate it. We just have to accept it on faith that there's somehow something bubbling in your hormones that gives you some mysterious access to knowledge. And that is not the case. As to there is no, how can individuals deal with one another if they don't accept reason as their absolute? If I say, you know, I just feel like stealing your money. I feel like slitting your throat. And nothing you say can dissuade me because, you know, you may have logic and reason on your side, but I just feel it. It's in my glands. What else can I say? That is, there's no answer to it.
Let me get a quick answer from Joanne, and then we'll hear Ariana.
Well, I'm not sure what analogy you're drawing. I'm not sure I understand your point on the second one, where you're talking about I just feel like slitting your throat, and logic and reason can't persuade that person. That's not what I'm referring to as mysticism. That business about I just feel like doing something, therefore I will do it.
But that is a form of mysticism, so how would you answer that?
Actually, I think, Peter, you just demonstrated the irrationality of pure reason. This is not mystical. This is just irrational. You're just attacking a caricature once again. And I couldn't agree with Joanne more. I mean, really, there is no way to argue against what Joanne said. And what I would say, that I have had experiences, I have had knowledge which was not reason, which was not rational, which was not from my mind, which you can say was from intuition, from dreams, from illumination, all these perfectly acceptable forms of knowledge with an amazing pedigree. And to say that you cannot communicate these things, what is poetry except a way to communicate beyond rationality? And just one last thing. When you talk about freedom, there is absolutely no way to sustain freedom without some form of social responsibility. You either have the law of the jungle or you have collectivism, unless you have some form of social responsibility that human beings get to just simply by maturing and by growing through the process of life.
I'll give you an alternative. What you have is the law of individual rights, where
and
each person respects...
Where is that utopia where it exists? Where is your golden age?
It will exist if people are willing to bring it about.
So
these things don't come down.
this extremely
these things don't
rational.
Come back from heaven. You know, they don't come down from heaven. These are man-made things. But I think I know what, you know, I think I realize maybe what some of the confusion here is. When I advocate reason, I am not saying that emotions have no role in human life. I just say that they're not your means of knowledge. The fact that you feel something does not mean it's true. The fact that you can logically prove it does mean it's true.
But Peter, let me jump in there, because we can't really leave the idea on the table that all decisions in life are submittable to this rigorous and purely rational form of decision making. Sometimes you got a fork in the road, and not all answers are as clear as 2 and 2 equals 4. And you're making it sound through your comments like they are, like they're
no,
all.
Now, man is not omniscient, Ray. You don't always know everything, and sometimes you just don't have the answer. But whenever you're looking for an answer, if you want to know which side of the fork to take, you don't just say, well, let me wait for the word of God to tell me. You say, is there any evidence one way or the other? Can I figure something out? If you can't, you say, well, I can't. But there's no knowledge unless you try to reason it out.
Arianna Huffington, we have about 30 seconds left.
Well, I would just really urge Peter to look at some of the things, I'm sure, Peter, in your own life, which were not strictly rational, and probably some of the most significant, most moving, most memorable things. And I think any human being would find things like that in one's own life that would challenge this purely rational, narrow, and extremely chilling view of life.
I want to call an end to it there because of the tyranny of the clock. I want to thank everyone who called, who wrote, and thank my guests. Peter Schwartz, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Peter Schwartz is chairman of the board of the Ayn Rand Institute and editor and contributing author of the forthcoming book, Return of the Primitive. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Arianna Huffington, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Ray.
Arianna Huffington is a syndicated columnist and an author. She joined us from NPR's Los Angeles Bureau. Earlier, we spoke with Michael Paxton, director of the documentary Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life, and the companion volume of the same name. Tune in to Talk of the Nation at this time tomorrow for a look at the 40th anniversary of Fidel Castro's rise to power in Cuba. In Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, NPR News.